Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this February 22nd Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with Ursula McTaggart, teacher of English at Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio. They discuss the U.S. response to the pandemic and the deep, intense dilemmas and troubles it created for mothers, especially those with little help and lower incomes. Patricia Kohlberg reads from and comments on two works by scholars of race and science, with an emphasis on how our values shape science. In the second half of our program, Joe Clement and guest Marianne Garneau return to conclude their series of talks about big strikes and the sabotage of labor. Marianne argues that to grow workers' power again and revive its legendary strength, the labor movement needs to return to shop floor struggles that put the pace, nature, and control of work at the center of organizing efforts. We conclude today's program with Jan Hocken, Old Mole and documentary filmmaker, talking with Tamara Dawit, director of the documentary feature Finding Sally, which screens on March 4th as part of the virtual Cascade Festival of African Films program. The Cascade Festival of African Films is free and open to the public and is the longest-running African film festival in the United States. For the first time in its history, the film festival is presented in an entirely online format. You can find more information at www.africanfilmfestival.org. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting community radio and programs like The Old Mole. And remember, you can find us on the web. Look for The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Ursula McTaggart.
Hello, Ursula McTaggart. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. It's nice to be here.
Ursula McTaggart teaches English at Wilmington College, a small liberal arts college, Quaker in origin, in Wilmington, Ohio. She writes a good deal, including a recent book, Gorillas in the Industrial Jungle, Radicalism's Primitive and Industrial Rhetoric. During the pandemic, she's been teaching her college classes while also at home mothering and co-teaching her two children. This experience led to doing some reading and research and lots of conversation with friends in the same position, and gave rise to her most recent article in the journal Against the Current. It's called Motherhood and Work in the Pandemic. In that article, Ursula McTaggart discusses first the intense dilemmas and troubles COVID has created for mothers, and especially in this country, especially those with little help and low income. And second, the article explores what should and could be done in the continuing pandemic as to income support and schooling and the structure of work. So, Ursula, let's start with the dilemmas and troubles. Not so many fulfillments of motherhood and work in the continuing pandemic.
I think that the pandemic has been a crisis for everyone, of course, but it has heightened inequalities in all sorts of situations, and one of those is gender inequalities. I don't want to diminish the other inequalities, racial inequalities, economic inequalities that it has also heightened. But thinking about within the home, the way that the pandemic has specifically affected mothers has been something that I've focused on recently. We already live in a society that prioritizes men's jobs over their domestic duties, and women are expected to make their careers bend to fulfill their domestic duties. The pandemic has intensified those gender inequalities. And I think that's because, on the whole, men don't feel that childcare and homeschooling are their primary responsibilities. This is true on a statistical level, a structural level. But I think it's also true on an individual level, even for many men who consider themselves feminists or leftists. Women do daily domestic labor that is often invisible to men or appears unnecessary to men, and men often prioritize their own paid labor over domestic tasks. And as a result, it's the women who end up managing those domestic tasks. I think that in the pandemic, what happened is that one day, many people suddenly were at home. So for people who were essential workers, what it meant is that their children were at home and they still had to go to work. For people who had white-collar jobs or other jobs that went online, it meant that the entire family was home, and now there were 40-hour-a-week jobs that had to be done online, and children who needed to do homeschool all day online, and this has been going on for a year. So I think that the trouble for women, both those who work outside of the home during the pandemic and those who are working from home, has been that childcare systems, whether that was the public schools or whether that was a daycare, have been stripped away, and children's care needs as well as their schooling needs suddenly need to be met by their parents at the same time that their parents are doing 40-hour-a-week jobs or more, of course. And that work has fallen on the whole to women. Not that men haven't been participating in it as well, but when we look at the stats of who's doing the majority of that homeschooling work, women are bearing the lion's share of the burden.
Yeah, and for people who are single or who don't have a partner involved, it's completely backbreaking, it seems to me, and an impossible set of burdens. An 80-hour week just can't continue. But even a 65-hour week with very little time to relax, it seems to me becomes sort of unbearable. The intensification of overwork is now becoming clear. My sense is that people won't return to it. Tell us how it is to always be juggling your work responsibilities and the responsibilities to young children who often don't have the capacity to sort of understand the dilemmas that their parents are facing.
So for me, both my children went back to school in person in September, and I also went back to teaching in person last September. To be honest, that's been good for all of us. It's been a much more normal. When we were all at home, I am divorced and on my own with the kids 65% of the time, which was 3 work days a week. And my kids were in 3rd grade and kindergarten at the time. It literally entailed setting them up downstairs, watching a television show or playing a video game, and then going up and shutting the door in my bedroom and teaching a class on Zoom, hoping that they didn't interrupt me, which sometimes they did. Sometimes they would bang on the door. Sometimes they would walk in. Sometimes toys would fly across the room and hit me while I'm talking. Most of the time, they're old enough that they would just watch their show for hours and hours a day, which isn't how I would normally like to parent, but that was my babysitter. And then when I was not teaching classes, I was getting them onto their Zoom classes or monitoring them while they did their homework, which was always its own challenge. So trying to do prep work for class or grading papers for class was something that had to move into the evenings after they went to bed or on days when they were with their dad. Because when I wasn't teaching on a Zoom class, I was parenting. I didn't have a lot of time to say to them, you need to entertain yourselves now while I grade 20 papers. They're young enough that they need a lot of supervision. That said, they're also old enough that I could set them up with a show and have them be occupied for an hour. I can't even imagine what it was like for people with infants and toddlers who literally cannot be entertained for an hour while you teach. You would have to hold them. There were certain cases I can imagine would be just impossibilities. If I were a single mom of a 2-year-old trying to teach a Zoom class, I don't honestly know if that could be done without just involving the toddler in the Zoom class. Like I said, I went back to teaching in September in person, and that actually made my life a lot more sane. But many people I know have been doing this dance for an entire year now.
It must be very debilitating for them in a lot of ways, exhausting, but also for conscientious people, at least, who value their work and recognize that it's important. It's one thing we've recognized in this pandemic. People who do humble things are often the ones who are keeping the society operating and have skills that we've never appreciated. My guess is that people in the position of working full days every day and trying to juggle the responsibilities they begin to feel that they're not really doing justice to either.
Yes, it's not possible to do good childcare and good work at your place of employment at the same time. It's just not. you do both of them poorly. Your kids watch hours and hours of television. You know, they run around unsupervised, and you're not playing with them. You're not reading to them. You're not doing all of the things that are lovely to do with children, crafts and sledding and whatever else is fun for them. You're not doing that the way that you would if you were primarily devoted to childcare. For me, at my job, I'm not giving my students as much feedback and attention to prepping classes as I would be if I weren't also doing childcare at the same time. So, absolutely. I think that for me, in the early days of the pandemic, there was some grace from everyone, which is that we're in a crisis, and as a result, everything is going to be done a little more poorly. Teachers weren't expecting as much from students in elementary school and just saying, oh, do what you can. And the same thing for me as an employee, there was a sense that, well, you've been thrown into this at a moment's notice. It doesn't have to be perfect. But I think that by September, employers had decided to crack down and say, you may be doing this from home, but we do expect that you do the exact same level of performance that you were doing before. And elementary school teachers have been given the message, you need to be expecting just as much of your students. You need to be doing as much teaching in the same way, whether you're in person or whether you're on Zoom. I understand why that happened, both from a capitalist perspective of employers wanting to extract as much work as they can from their employees, and also just on a social perspective that it's hard to live in a state of crisis for an entire year and not get anything done. But the fact is that the situation hadn't changed for many parents. Now, teachers expected more of their elementary age students and their employers expected more of them, but they were still trying to do both jobs at the same time. And it's just been extremely unsustainable, and people are having mental health crises and are in a state of complete exhaustion at this stage.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for KBOO 90.7 FM and our Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Ursula McTaggart, who teaches English at Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio. She's the principal caretaker and teacher for her two children at home during the pandemic. We've been discussing the intense dilemmas and troubles that COVID has created for mothers, especially those with little help and low income. That's, of course, the result of the way U.S. political and economic elites have responded to the pandemic. So, Ursula McTaggart, you concluded your article, Motherhood and Labor in the Pandemic, with several observations. For one, that the pandemic has demanded the changes in daily life that have forced not just mothers, but a considerable segment of the population to, for one, see the world differently, and secondly, envision radically democratic possibilities. So how did you come to those conclusions, and then what do you see as necessary changes in work and income and schooling?
So I think there are things that we can grasp from the experience of the pandemic and take forward with us. The first thing is the knowledge that change can happen overnight. I think that people who advocate big change, like socialists, are often told, oh, these things are very entrenched. You can't just change things overnight. But March 13th of 2020, the world did change overnight. We saw people change the entire way they organized their lives and their work worlds. And I think we should be inspired by that. It was because we had a crisis, but we can also change overnight for many reasons. We can change overnight because we want to, because it is in the interest of justice to change overnight. I think another thing the pandemic has taught us is that teachers and caregivers are some of the most important people in society, and that we need to reward them as such. We need to prioritize their needs, and we need to prioritize the work that they do. That includes prioritizing things like in-person teaching. I think that higher education, where I work for many years, has pushed people towards more and more online teaching as a way to make more money. And now we know how to do online teaching, but I think what we've learned is that it can work in a pinch, but it's certainly not as good. People want to be in person with teachers. Teachers have valuable things to give them in in-person settings. So I think we should remember the value of all of those things moving forward, of in-person teaching and of caregiving and teaching in general. I think that what we could have done but didn't, but we could still do going forward if we were willing to radically reimagine things in a democratic way, is to think about really funding and prioritizing what matters in this society. We decided that we were going to prioritize capitalism in the pandemic, that instead of mass government bailouts for everyone and everything, so that everything could shut down long enough for everyone to be safe, so that small businesses didn't have to go under if they weren't serving people in bars and restaurants in person, so that higher education felt like it could come out alive if it didn't force students to come back into dorm living in the fall. We should have, as a society, bailed all of those businesses out enough that they could survive the pandemic without requiring people to do dangerous things. And we should have put all of our resources into bringing back caregiving and in-person K through 12 teaching safely as soon as possible. By safely, I mean we could have worked on radically reducing class sizes, hiring masses and masses of new teachers so that we could have very small pods of students being taught masked outside during the fall, maybe with breaks for online teaching in the wintertime. We could have compensated teachers much more for the work that they're doing to encourage them to come into these kinds of positions. We could have made sure that school buildings were safe, had the ventilation that they needed, that people had the space that they needed. Obviously, infrastructure doesn't change overnight, but I think this was an opportunity to get moving on changing the infrastructure that we need to have schools with smaller class sizes. Smaller class sizes would have been healthy for COVID. They're also healthy for the future. Pedagogical research tells us that 15-person classes are ideal at all ages. My children have 25-person classes. Some school systems have 40-person classes. This is not the way we should be educating our kids in any circumstance. Why not say now, today, in a pandemic, is the time when we really decide to reduce class sizes? We could have done that. It would have taken a lot of money. It would have taken a big push from states and the federal government. But I think these are the kinds of things that we could have prioritized in the pandemic that would have benefited us going forward as well. And last, I will say, I think we needed income support and alternative childcare support for people who didn't feel comfortable sending their kids back to in-person schooling throughout the pandemic. Depending on your employment situation, you may have been facing a situation where you had to send your children to in-person school or you had to send your children to in-person daycare, even if you didn't feel comfortable with that. We needed more options for people to make choices that were safe or that they felt were safe. Obviously, there's concern about government spending, but I think that other countries around the world have been much more open to seeing this as kind of the epitome of a crisis where we need government spending to get out of it. It is our path out, and we did it a little bit with the CARES Act, and there were some good provisions in there that helped, but we didn't take it nearly far enough.
Ursula McTaggart, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. Later in our program, we'll hear about the film Finding Sally, which screens on March 4th as part of the Virtual Cascade Festival of African Films program. And we'll hear from Joe Clement and Marianne Garneau, who continue their discussion on big strikes and the sabotage of labor. Next up, we have Patricia Kohlberg on race and science.
Good morning. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and today, in honor of Black History Month, I would like to revisit an update, a discussion from a century ago about the role of science in promoting white supremacy. It's been a bad few years for science. We've witnessed both a vicious attack on science as untrustworthy and irrelevant, and a corresponding defense of science as an unimpeachable guide to a better future. The truth lies somewhere in between. As a former physician and a current climate justice activist, I've been steeped in the principles of science and its practical application for decades. In my experience, science can as easily fail us as support us in the project of dismantling social injustice. Many folks harbor a deep suspicion of scientific findings, which is well-founded given a long history of the abuse and misuse of science by an array of private and public entities. Science has value only when practiced with integrity and transparency, but sometimes even that is not enough. All of us approach the material world from the vantage point of our values, and our values shape what we observe and how we observe it. During the mid-20th century epidemic of polio, for example, doctors examined the muscles of polio patients and judged that the sick muscles were those that appeared paralyzed. This fit in nicely with prevailing values around doctor-patient hierarchy and the passivity of the patient, who had to submit to long periods of enforced rest for the muscles to recover. Then along came a medical outsider, a nurse from the outback of Australia, Sister Elizabeth Kenny, whose own values emphasized self-reliance and the insistence on active participation of the patient. She examined those same muscles of the polio patient and came to the exact opposite conclusion. The sick muscles, she said, were those that were abnormally contracted, like a Charlie horse, not those that appeared flaccidly paralyzed. It took her more than 30 years to prove the value of her observations and revolutionize the care of polio patients. All of these issues regarding the practice of science were at play at the turn of the last century, when W.E.B. Du Bois began his critical examination of science and racism. Jordan Bezek is an assistant professor of sociology at University at Buffalo. I'm going to read sections from an article he recently published in an online journal, The Conversation. Bezek writes, "The NAACP published the first issue of The Crisis 110 years ago. For almost 2.5 decades, sociologist and civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois served as its editor, famously using this platform to dismantle scientific racism. At the time, many widely respected intellectuals gave credence to beliefs that empirical evidence exists to justify a natural white superiority. Tearing down scientific racism was thus a necessary project for The Crisis. Under Du Bois's leadership, the magazine laid bare the irrationality of scientific racism. Less remembered, however, is how it also sought to help its readers understand and engage with contemporary science. Du Bois's editorship was just as much about critically embracing careful, systematic, empirical science as it was about skewering the popular view that blacks were naturally inferior. Du Bois's insistence on a critical embrace of science can be an important part of that struggle for an emancipated politics and can help people better tackle pressing issues like environmental justice, healthcare disparities, and more. Du Bois demonstrated how to reject racist science without rejecting the ways that science can help people better understand our relationships with the world and that our relationships with each other are not determined by nature but are under our own control." That was Jordan Bezek writing in The Conversation about W.E.B. Du Bois and his reflections on science. A century later, scientific racism is not dead. Dorothy Roberts, professor of law and sociology at University of Pennsylvania, writes about what she calls the emerging biopolitics of race in her 2011 book entitled Fatal Invention: How Science, Politics, and Big Business Recreate Race in the 21st Century. She writes, "Only a decade ago, the biological concept of race seemed finally to have met its end. The Human Genome Project, which mapped the entire human genetic code, proved that race could not be identified in our genes. On June 26, 2000, when President Bill Clinton unveiled the draft genomic sequence, he famously declared that, quote, human beings, regardless of race, are 99.9% the same. But, as Rogers notes, reports of the demise of race as a biological category were premature. Instead of hammering the last nail in the coffin of an obsolete system, the science that emerged from sequencing the human genome was reshaped by a resurgence of interest in race-based genetic variation. She goes on to detail the ways scientists exploit dubious scientific findings to shore up antiquated racial classifications and create opportunities for profit-making. The worst consequence, Rogers writes, is that this delusion of biological inferiority permits a majority of Americans to live in perfect comfort with a host of barbaric practices and conditions that befall blacks primarily. Rogers makes a further crucial point. She writes, it would be a mistake to think of this work to establish race as a biological phenomenon as confined to scientific racism. The term implies an exceptional use of science to support racist ideas. Calling it scientific racism identifies the problem as scientists' corrupt misuse of race rather than their support of race itself. What Rogers points to is that racist ways of looking at the world penetrate the practice of science and shape its findings. Science cannot be free of racist bias until society itself is free. I've been reading today from Jordan Bisick's examination of W.E.B. Du Bois's century-old writings on scientific racism and Dorothy Rogers' book on today's particular reincarnation of racist science and how it serves the interests of capital. Later today, on the Old Mole webpage, we'll post links to the article, the book, and other related works that might interest you, our listeners. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, reading and commenting today for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Next on the Old Mole, Joe Clement and Marianne Garneau return to conclude their series of talks about big strikes and the sabotage of labor.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking again today with Marianne Garneau, an organizer and educator with the Industrial Workers of the World. She's also a publisher of Organizing Work at organizing.work. That's an online publication written by and for workers who are trying to organize their workplaces and want to learn both from what does and doesn't work. For the last few weeks, we've been talking about big strikes and the sabotage of labor, the name and theme of a piece that she wrote late last year about the labor movement and how it used to be grounded in direct shop floor action for controlling the workplace and asserting workers' fundamental power in it, and its transformation into a beast of bureaucracy and legislation, and ultimately is about tying the hands of workers and making it so that they cannot use the power that everyone knows they have. Last week, we were talking about public sector workers, and we had gotten on to talking about just the nature of so-called whistle bargaining on the shop floor, and whether something like that would fly in workplaces today.
So that kind of immediate stop and go, screw it, we're downing tools until this particular grievance is fixed, and a lot of those grievances had to do with the pace of work. That's what the labor movement used to look like, which is absolutely unheard of today. So I take you to be asking, if people acted that way in the case of a lot of public sector work, wouldn't that look like screwing over students and screwing over patients and whatnot? And the answer is, like, not necessarily, right? Because I'm in regular contact now with teachers, workers in healthcare, and a lot of time what their issue is, what their grievance is being told to do ridiculously unsafe things at work. And unfortunately, the union system we have nowadays generally says, work now, grieve later. You know, people think, oh, well, health and safety complaints are an exception to this. There's a carve out for that. Yeah, kind of technically, legally, there sort of is. But on a day-to-day level, for the most part, you cannot simply stop work. And the union is not even structured to defend you if you stop work. And by that, I'm referring to, for example, refusing to do something unsafe, refusing to do something ridiculous that the employer is asking you to do, and doing the right thing instead. For the most part, unions are no longer the kind of institutions that have the capacity to back you up in doing that. They still try to, right? But my point is that, for the most part, that's not what worker activity looks like, and that's not the kind of worker activity that is sanctioned by the legal system and by the government, and therefore it's not, for the most part, the way that unions are able to behave. They have to behave in such a way that they use these formal processes instead. So public sector workers can and should be able to control their work on a day-to-day level, and in fact, a lot of times they do kind of manage to get away with controlling their work on a day-to-day level in a way that does serve the public better than if they were simply following the rules. One of the ways that ends up unfortunately happening is like teachers bringing their own supplies into school. That's not an exertion of power in relation to the employer, but that's skirting the way things officially work in order to actually deliver a better product to the public or a better service to the public.
Just in the last few years, there were lots of collective refusals by teachers to administer standardized tests, which is refusing to, you know, do the work that is expected of them by their bosses. And yet it's not working. They're choosing to do something else, something more educational. I mean, just the other week on KBOO Labor Radio, two Portland public school teachers were hosting and talking to two other Portland public school teachers about why they, as workers, as teachers, and as members of their union, why they oppose MAP testing and how they're working with parents and students to put control over classroom time back in the teacher's hand. And I'm wondering whether this is a missing piece of the puzzle around when people say direct action gets the goods. Direct action isn't just this negative thing where we're stopping another agency from acting through us, but rather reclaiming our agency.
Yeah, the reality is that workers are the best judges and adjudicators of their own work, including best serving the public and so on. I have a kind of frustration with the bargaining for the common good language, which is what gets used to describe when you reach out to the public and build those supports with them in advance of bargaining, like teachers have done in Chicago and elsewhere. That kind of implicitly frames the public interest as being different from the union's interest. We've had an anti-union narrative for decades that says that they chauvinistically and selfishly want to bargain up their own wages, they want to bargain up their own benefits, they don't care how much it costs the employer, how much it costs the public, they don't care if this negatively affects workers elsewhere, which it actually doesn't, but they selfishly care about their own interests, and that's what unions do, is they just narrowly fight for a better deal for their own members. And the inside of bargaining for the common good is supposed to be like, okay, let's go to the public and ask about what they want and then try to bring that up at the bargaining table and create an alloy of worker interests and public interests. And I call BS on that. I think that worker interests are public interests.
That reminds me of how a month ago on Democracy Now! They quoted AOC supporting the Hunts Point produce market strike. And she was saying, when you're standing on this line, you're not just asking for a dollar. You're asking for transformational change for your lives and for the lives of every food worker across the country, for kids of food workers across the country, because there's lots of things upside down right now in our economy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care whether it's public sector or private sector. Anytime workers bargain their wages up, that's a good thing. That's good for the working class. First of all, it's good for those workers and they're part of the working class. And second, that does empower and encourage workers to strike elsewhere. And it also encourages employers to increase how much they pay because now they're in competition with that other employer to attract workers. So it's just a good thing.
I want to return to a little bit of the history here of the transformation of labor struggle from shop floor to contracts and collective bargaining. That was a phrase invoked by one of the historians you quote as a failure for the labor movement when I think the normal narrative is that earning collective bargaining rights through the NLRA was one of the grandest achievements of 20th century labor. In what sense was it a failure?
Well, one of the things that struck me that I put in the article is Martin Glauberman talks about the Flint sit-down strike. And he points out, he has a very short book or pamphlet called Punching Out. He points out that the contract that was won by the Flint sit-down strike was one page. And quoting Glauberman, he says, "The old-timers look on that as the contract under which the greatest gains were made because the bargaining and the decisions were made by the workers on the job. There wasn't enough in it to prevent the workers from doing pretty much as they pleased. Four men, for the first time, asked the steward how much production the department would get so he could plan accordingly. The steward consulted with the men and then gave his answer to the foreman." So workers collectively making decisions at work about what the pace of work is going to be and then delivering those instructions to the boss. That's incredible. And over time, contracts have evolved in two ways. For the first couple of years, they were giving workers more. We heard about that with the Treaty of Detroit thing that I mentioned. So they're giving workers more job security. They're giving the union more security in the form of shoring up its position as a recognized bargaining agent, ensuring that all members of the workplace would be members. And they were giving workers more for a while in terms of wages and benefits. But what workers were losing was the ability to democratically decide issues of production and to push back on things like that and to take action in the workplace. And so you eventually had things like management rights clauses, which said like everything outside of this contract is just entirely management's prerogative. The business belongs to them. They get to make all decisions with respect to running it. It really eliminated that day-to-day struggle between workers and bosses over the pace of work and the nature of work. Contracts, as we know them today, outline things like wages and benefits and to some extent working conditions, but all control is given to management with respect to the flow of work, the type of work, the nature of work, when it stops, when it starts, when it gets shut down completely. And that was a huge loss.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Marianne Garneau, with the Industrial Workers of the World and publisher of Organizing.Work, talking about big strikes and the sabotage of labor and revising some historical notions we have about workers' power. So what does it mean for workers today who have a union or most of them don't, as far as engaging in collective action to change their workplaces, that there is so little intuition around it. There's so little in the culture that supports workers having a say. We don't have that same intuition, it seems, that workers had 100 years ago around controlling their work because it's them, it's their life. How do we make labor struggle about having agency as a worker again?
Well, there are places where that is still happening. One of the places they're still happening is in a lot of IWW organizing, which is what continues to make it interesting, where instead of simply signing cards and petitioning for a certification election and getting formal recognition and then sitting at the bargaining table, workers just take direct action in the workplace in order to get their demands met. And I collect those stories on Organizing Work. It's one of the reasons I started the website, because I do think it would be nice for workers to just see what that could possibly look like and possibly follow that example. One of the other ways that you can disseminate that kind of practice is through education programs, which is why I think that labor education, popular worker labor education, is very important. It's why I'm a trainer of workers for the IWW's organizer training program, which just basically entirely empowers them. How do you do this yourself? How do you talk to your coworkers? How do you start making decisions collectively with your coworkers? How do you take action in the workplace? How do you protect yourself from retaliation? And most people in the labor movement, when you try to describe that to them, honestly just can't grok what you're talking about. It runs so counter to the way that unions normally look and labor is normally organized. It's not even that people are necessarily hostile to it, but it's just something that's been entirely written out of account by the labor relations model. In the U.S. context, you fortunately still have what are called Section 7 protections, where you are allowed to take concerted activity at work to try to improve things on the job. In Canada, which is often looked to as a kind of bastion of social democracy compared to the U.S., including with respect to labor relations, you don't have those protections. You absolutely are expected to follow the formal processes of getting formal union recognition and then bargaining at a table. And if you don't do that, the labor relations board and most unions look at you like you've got two heads. They think you're trying to cheat and skirt labor processes. Again, this is a tradition that's largely been written out of account. There's also one more thing I want to say about sabotage. I think the important thing about sabotage for anybody who's listening to this and thinking about their own workplace is that it's not something you want to undertake individually. It doesn't work because you just happen to have thrown a shoe into the machine. The only reason it works is because workers collectively have an intention to slow down work or to refuse certain kinds of work or what have you, right? If you're in an assembly line and you just hit the emergency button and stop that assembly line, you're just going to get yourself disciplined, if not fired, and in trouble. If all of the workers on that assembly line collectively made a decision to shut down that assembly line until some grievance was resolved, they have more protection in that because they can't all be dismissed or fired or production doesn't continue for that day. So sabotage, especially among young people and leftists and in our very, very individualist society, is often thought of as like, haha, all I have to do is throw the switch and then I'm a hero and I've got one over on the boss. The reality is nothing could be riskier than acting as an individual. The important and significant sense of sabotage is for people to be doing something collectively.
And that makes me want to ask a bit more about what I think we can put a finer point on about the relationship between building worker power and then having the big movement. I see you as sketching out a theory of power where we get to the capacity to pull off big powerful action by developing a ground level understanding of our own capacity to then coordinate and our own capacity to, I don't want to say do what we want, but do what we need to do. And could you speak more to that relationship between the two levels? Because I know in the IWW, there has been controversy around, you know, how do we organize? Do we organize shop by shop, or we're an industrial union? Don't we, you know, need to organize whole industries? And I see you as intervening in that by saying, how do you think we get to industrial scale organizing without having a workers' culture of this shop floor struggle?
Yeah, I ran a piece recently, not by me, about the Alphabet Workers Union at Google and how it's the latest example of top-first organizing, not top-down, but top-first, which sort of describes how you can build all kinds of beautiful structures from above that say, like, this is going to be a union for, like, all, I don't know, Whole Foods workers or Instacart workers or every rideshare driver or everybody working in tech. But if you never really fill that in with worker action at the ground level, then it kind of doesn't really tend to go anywhere except in media spaces, let's say. To the broader point about building worker power, talk to any union organizer and they will tell you how difficult it is to build towards a strike, how much work is required to build towards a strike, especially in a large bargaining unit with a couple thousand or tens of thousands of members. I mean, it's just hours and hours and hours of building members up and agitating them about the issues, encouraging them to go on strike and building towards that strike vote. And it's very difficult to organize. And the reason it's difficult to organize is because the rest of the time, the worker's job is to basically keep your head down and report to work. And if you have an issue on the job, you're supposed to hand it off to the grievance process and to the labor relations staff, basically, to address in that boardroom that is off the worksite. It's very hard to swing from that kind of passivity in that service model to suddenly you're out risking your ass on a picket line and out on strike with your coworkers. And so one of the jabs I make in my article is about how people love to look back at these huge strikes that happened, like the Flint sit-down strike or other ones in the 1930s, and say, like, man, look at how militant these workers were. Just like hundreds of or thousands of workers sat down at once and went on strike. And my point is that the reason why they had that ability and what was sort of like fertilizing that was the fact that they exercised control on the job on a day-to-day basis. They did engage in things like sabotage and intermittent strikes and group refusals and pickets and whatever. It didn't look like balloting for a strike every 3 years. It looked like a constant day-to-day fight with the foreman in the shop. You know, like the metaphor that you read at the end of my introduction, it's like demanding a wheel without an axle. The people who really want to reinvigorate the big strike, my question is, how do you really do that in a powerful way while completely giving up and writing out of account the whole issue of the day-to-day struggle over the shop floor? And people recognize that we can only get the kind of big strikes that matter if we are willing to defy the law, if we are willing to sort of be more militant than the law allows us to be. How are you going to get workers to that level? I think you have to build on a sort of shop floor level and engage the immediate practice of collective action at work on a day-to-day level if you're going to get there.
There is this counterintuitive route to the big strike that we don't organize for the big strike per se. We build up worker power and a sense of agency over the work that we do and our dignity when we're doing it. And that is really the goal, to have agency in our work lives and maybe even someday like call it democracy or something. But it's more transactional to just look at like the big strike as kind of like what organizing is, what the prize is that we're supposed to keep our eyes on. And it's really helpful the way that you're trying to bring these back together, because it's a missing link and it's hard to see, because it's not like the end all be all of like the labor movement is to just go on strike. Big Bill Haywood, you know, famously said all the workers have to do is get organized and put their hands in their pockets and they'd have the employing class whipped. But it's not like that's the point. The point is that is a tool in this larger project of reclaiming our lives at work.
And it's about day-to-day dignity on the job, and it is about that democratic worker control. I want to read one more quote from the article, which is an IWW spokesman who said in 1913, so decades before the Labor Relations Act, the employer can better afford to fight one strike that lasts 6 months than he can fight six strikes that take place in the same period. I think that's absolutely true. I previously, about a year or two ago, wrote an article called Why Don't Strikes Achieve More? And it was right after the settlement of the Stop and Shop strike, as well as, you know, I think that one of the symphony orchestras and big strike in Canada at a grocery. I think every single one of them settled with a two-tier contract. Those were all-out strikes, actual withdrawals of labor power. They were majoritarian strikes. They lasted for a long time. The workers fought incredibly courageously, and they probably got a better deal than they would have had they not struck. But there's a bit of a mythologizing of the strike, like, well, if only we would strike, then we would get what we wanted. And reality is that's not the case. And it's not the case because, again, the labor relations framework overall has so tamed unions. If you go on strike, your employer, they know from the minute they sign the contract when that strike is going to be. It's going to be after the expiration of the contract. They also know that first the union has to do things like ballot for it and prepare for it and whatever. They also know exactly what it's going to look like. It's going to look like an orderly picket line, you know, for the most part, right? And they get to replace those workers with scabs and so on and so forth. It's extraordinarily constrained. It still does matter, it absolutely, and it still does affect the employer. But the all-out strike every couple of years is a tactic that employers are very much aware of and prepare for, and they've had basically like 90 years to figure out workarounds. Whereas ongoing disruption on the job, I think, is something that they have less of a response to. And it's worth us as the labor movement investing in that kind of thing so that we can engage in that and we can develop power from the bottom up again, and it'll make us all the better prepared to carry out big strikes.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That's all the time we have today for my conversation with Marianne Garneau, but we're not going to make you wait another week to hear the rest. When you go and find today's show posted the next couple days at kboo.fm/oldmole, we will have an additional 15-20 minutes of conversation that completes our long series of talks about big strikes and the sabotage of labor, published at organizing.org. Thanks for coming back on the Old Mole, Marianne Garneau.
Thanks for having me back.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement.
We conclude today's program with Jan Hawken, Old Mole and documentary filmmaker, talking with Tamara Dawit, director of the documentary feature Finding Sally. It screens on March 4th as part of the virtual Cascade Festival of African Films program here in Portland. Jan?
Welcome to KABOO, Tamara Dawit.
Thank you for having me on.
Working between Canada and Ethiopia, Tamara Dawit is a film producer and director and runs the production company Gobez Media, which produces Ethiopian film, TV, digital, and music content. Dawit directed Finding Sally, which had its North American premiere in 2020 and is screening on March 4th as part of the virtual Cascade Festival of African Films program here in Portland. Tamara, this film is quite riveting and unfolds as a personal journey of self-discovery as you travel to Ethiopia, the native country of your parents, to uncover a painful part of that family history and the disappearance of a beloved Aunt Salamawit, or Aunt Sally. And this convention of the personal journey departs in some interesting ways from the conventions of this same genre. The journey to a place that is both foreign and familiar, that operates at both personal and political levels. Start by talking about what you sought to convey politically and personally through this documentary project and how you conceived of the story.
Sure. I think for me, it's that I wanted to understand why I had an aunt that I knew nothing about. On the one hand, I wanted to really investigate the facts of her life. And on the other hand, I wanted to understand why had my family, whether intentionally or unintentionally, not mentioned her to me? Why was there this emotional baggage related to Sally? And why was she sort of the missing voice in the narrative of the family history? And I realized really quickly that this wasn't something, you know, only specific to my family. This was something as well that affects many other Ethiopian families in this history of secrecy and silence around things that are traumatic and painful. So those were really my investigative goals to try and unpack and understand.
There are many stories that involve uncovering a traumatic part of family history, and often it's related to a shameful secret or a betrayal of some sort, as well as a loss. But part of what I found so compelling about your documentary is it's really a proud story too, and it's not a conventional trauma narrative. These are strong women. The women are the chroniclers of that history, and they are recovering in many ways a proud part of the family history. It doesn't draw on many of the trauma conventions that are common in films.
Yeah, I would agree with you, certainly. And I think that, you know, the process of making the film for my grandmother, for my aunts, was an opportunity for them to actually think about their sister, think about themselves in terms of their relationship with her, and realize that it's okay to talk about her and that we actually have wonderful, fond memories about her. Or we're proud of her. Maybe there's some regrets we have in terms of how we interacted with her or things we said or didn't get time to say. But I think it's just that, you know, it was a painful experience for them when Sally was missing. And, you know, this was also a period when Ethiopia was under a brutal military dictatorship, and it was not encouraged or even safe to talk about people like Sally who were opposing the government. So when you know it's dangerous to remember her, when you know it's dangerous to mourn your sister or to celebrate her, it becomes a habit. And then I think that's exactly what happened. They didn't not tell me about her because of some intention to hide it. It was just part of a pattern of this is something that's happened to us and we're not to talk about it. And I think it's only in the last decade that Ethiopians have started talking about this period.
There are habits of silence that are tied to political repression, but also require a condition for the recovery of memory. And you're talking about your own role as a family member and documentarian, a daughter, a niece, coming to this place and creating this space for both recovering memory and creating an account in a way.
Yeah, and I think I also had maybe a heightened degree of access or privilege to push my family to investigate and interrogate these memories, because I grew up in Canada. As much as I'm Ethiopian, I'm also Canadian. And as a member of the diaspora, maybe I'm a bit more bold and blunt than had a Ethiopian born and bred filmmaker approach this project in the same way. I mean, I frequently get questions, you know, how did you ask that of your aunts? How did you get them to talk about this? And I think a lot of it has to do with me being Canadian and how I was raised to be really blunt.
Yeah, also that insider-outsider position, and that many of your aunts were very modern women by conventional standards and had lived in various places, fairly cosmopolitan, very articulate.
Yeah, my family was raised differently, certainly my aunts, than many other Ethiopian women of their generation. I mean, one of the things one of my aunts told me when I was doing research from this was that her parents, specifically my grandfather, raised them as if they were men. And he told them that you are the same as any man, you are no different. So that did give them maybe a heightened level of confidence as they entered adulthood and how they saw their position in the world and their ability to lead their lives and create change. And I think that's exactly how you end up with an individual like Sally that really is laser focused on going after what she thinks is important.
Sometimes there's a space granted women in narrative and documentary films to tell a personal story of hardship and suffering, but not to venture into the large scale landscape of war and resistance. And I so much appreciated your positioning women as the chroniclers of this political history. And also, it wasn't a right-wing reaction to communist military dictatorship there, which often happens where you have stories coming to North America or reactionary movements in response to brutal periods of repressive communist regimes. What was your sense of the politics of what you tried to bring to what is a very complex history, and where you use the family story as this brilliant window into that complex history without being reductionistic about it? What was your interest in conveying the politics of that history as they relate to the contemporary upheavals in Ethiopia?
Yeah, I mean, I think two approaches. One, I really wanted to tell the story only from a female point of view, because I think women remember history differently and with more complexities and nuances than men. And when we look at this period in Ethiopia of the Red Terror and the revolution, most of the memories that are documented are from a male perspective. So that, for me, first of all, was very important. And then when it comes to looking at the political history, the political landscape of that period, I wasn't trying to do the film with a specific political agenda. I wanted Sally's voice to be in the film in terms of what her ideology was and her party. But I really wanted to try and focus on the facts, the hard facts we know of what happened. What was the brutality of the Derg military dictatorship? What were the aspirations of the EPRP? And also realize that there's a lot of political background that can't necessarily fit into a film, and to try and offer more context for viewers through the film's website. So those were sort of my objectives from a content perspective and a voice of the film. And I think my aim in making the film was also that I realized young Ethiopians today don't have access to information on what happened in the 1970s. They don't have an understanding of what those aspirations for, what the ramifications were of what happened in that time. And I think it's important to, you know, look over our shoulders, look in our rearview mirror and understand what's happened in the past and what lessons can we learn from that and how can we apply critical thinking going forward. And this is all incredibly, incredibly important today in Ethiopia because of the situation politically in the country and because the country is heading into a federal election.
And I think often the revolutionary left, or what some might call the radical left or the far left, gets collapsed into a very narrow window of representations. And here you have the repressiveness of the Soviet-backed military dictatorship and the Red Terror, but you have her voice as part of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Party, the EPRP. You brought into view some of the tensions and differences within the revolutionary left, and that she was kind of a bearer of possibilities that were brutally crushed and not realized in that period. And I think at the end, you do speak to that.
For me, the film is, as much as it's about the brutality of that period, it's also about hope. The EPRP and Sally and her peers had a lot of hope and aspirations for the country that unfortunately largely were not met for a number of reasons because of what happened in the revolution. And I think young people today have many similar aspirations and hopes. I think it's about looking backwards at the same time as going forward and learning from our history and realizing sometimes maybe we don't have to always reinvent the wheel, but we have to be really clear and really engaged in terms of what we want going forward.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Tamara Dowitt, director of Finding Sally, that will be part of our beloved Cascade Festival of African Films, an institution that has a big following here in Oregon. And you'll be available for a Q&A on March 4th after the screening. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. And we look forward to seeing you again during the screening Q&A. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
That concludes our program for this morning on KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. A big thank you to our KBOO Corps, who have been keeping this non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over this last year. It takes a labor. I want to remind people of the Festival of African Films. Go to www.africanfilmfestival.org. Thanks to our guests and contributors this morning, Patricia Kohlberg, Bill Resnick, Ursula McTaggart, Jan Hawken, Tamara Dowitt, Joe Clement, and Marianne Garneau. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective.